morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And Rabbit, you know what the theme is. I don't know what the theme is.
I do. Today. Well, I don't know. It's sort of we're between St. Patrick's Day and Passover, and we have a guest who's going to talk to us about sort of related to both of those subjects, an old friend in the wine business who's developing some fascinating new sparkling wines. Those of you who are getting ready to celebrate Easter, perhaps, but rather than Passover, will find very suitable for that celebration. But if not, they're wines you should lay your hands on for any time you're celebrating. And then some fascinating characters with a company called New York Mouth. and you'll have to wait to find out what they do. You can sort of guess it's something to do with food, but it really is rather interesting. So that's today's program. But starting off in the spirit of Passover coming tomorrow, I think. We caught up with a lady in South Wales.
Yeah, that was interesting.
In Britain. I can't say it's part of England, but it's certainly part of Britain, even though the Welsh might not like it to be. But her ethnic tradition is Jewish, and she just produced a wonderful book called Traditional Jewish Cooking. So we thought it would be a great thing to bring to you for next week's celebration. Starting tomorrow. And don't worry, if you don't have a copy of the book, if you go to Amazon.com and Traditional Jewish Cooking by Ruth Joseph, you can actually look inside the book and read some of the pages. So you can't have it delivered tomorrow, but you can have the opportunity to look at it. So let's go to Ruth, and you're sure to want to, I think, after you hear what she has to say.
I have to say that even though at this time of the year around the Jewish holidays, we tend to get a lot of Jewish cookbooks, but this one that we received from Ruth Joseph, co-written with Simon Round, is a landmark cookbook. Congratulations, Ruth, on establishing a whole new level of Jewish traditional cooking with this book.
Oh, thank you so much. That's lovely of you to say
that.
Well,
it is, and the book contains over 150, it says, nostalgic and contemporary Jewish recipes, and I want to suggest that it's really very far afield also in terms of different ethnic cultures within the Jewish ethnic community.
Yes, that's right.
And, I mean, you have Sephardic, you have, what else, Levant, you have all kinds of different things. And you yourself live in Cardiff, Wales?
I live in Cardiff, Wales, yes. But I'm very blessed because I came from a strictly Ashkenazi background. Grandparents were in Germany and they had a tough time. Unfortunately, they perished in the Holocaust. But my mother came over to England then when she was 12 with a kinder transport, and she came from a rabbi's home. She knew how to do everything perfectly, and she passed all that knowledge on to me. And then when I married a Sephardi man. And I picked up a lot of wonderful information from his family, and his family came from Palestine.
Oh, wow.
Very interesting. And their origins were Spanish. So I have the two sides very beautifully linked within my soul.
And in your book, I mean, I love these recipes. Aside from when you're going to have them, I just think that the ethnic origins are so varied that the book itself is just fascinating. Is it? I mean, you come from a, you said your mother was a rabbi's daughter.
Yes.
You mentioned
yes, she was the chief rabbi of Hamburg.
Really? Now, you mentioned in your book some unusual circumstances, such as the fact that she was anorexic, and therefore you were overfed, weighed over 200 pounds as a growing up.
Yes, that's right. I don't anymore, thank goodness.
No,
I managed to get rid of that quick.
But, I mean, that, and you have a son who's a vegetarian, your husband has high cholesterol. I mean, you have to jump through a lot of hoops to get really good food on the table, huh?
Yes, I think I've always looked at it as a challenge, and I love making things tempting for people. So if I can manage to make lovely food and cheer them all up, then it's really good. And for this Passover, in fact, I had the ultimate challenge because I have a non-Jewish couple coming because I want it. It's nice to show that Passover to non-Jewish people that they understand how we celebrate Exodus and so on. But the lady is vegan. And that makes the job. I mean, Passover's all eggs. Passover's all eggs. How on earth do you do it? So I'm making her the vegetable tagine that's in the book, and I'm going to sprinkle it with toasted almonds so that she will get some nice protein. And I'm going to attempt to make knedlach without eggs. So I shall make her a nice bit of poached fruit and apple tart as well without eggs. We'll have a nice.
I think you should make that recipe with the calf's feet in it. And tell her what it's in it and she should get over it.
My best friend growing up, her brother was vegan and we used to have some interesting seders.
Oh, it makes it, you know, just for Passover, that really, I mean, I that is a tough one. But we've managed fine. And I started, did the cooking today, my daughter and I started, scrubbed all the tops down, and we made the lovely kremslach, you know, the big puffy pancakes. They're sitting in the freezer now, very happily. And in the book is a carrot and almond bake. And
that's vegetarian.
Yes. Now, so that's done.
Your publicist suggested that we ask you what you're actually going to prepare for.
What I'm going to prepare, I can tell you with pleasure.
Okay.
We're going to start, well, you know the egg and salt water is mandatory.
Right, you have to do that.
For my lovely vegan friend, I'm afraid she's going to have a potato with salt water because
that's a great idea. Shape it like an egg.
Well,
that's
you know, you've got to do the thing, haven't you?
Yes.
And I thought this little ones can look kind of similar. And then we'll have a lovely vegetable soup with, it's the kind of thing because we're veggie. So it'll be, because my son is there as well, so it'll be a vegetarian, it's like chicken soup without the chicken. Loads and loads of lovely veg cooked together, and then very nice knedlach. My son adores that to me. In fact, if he's to his own places, he just has the soup and knedlach, because as far as he's concerned, that's the best thing in the world. And then after that, we're going to have there's the most glorious picture in the book of the spinach and cheesy leek roulade.
Oh, yes.
What you do is you cook up some lovely spinach and then you fold it into a savoury meringue mix, basically, and you bake it and then you roll it up Swiss roll with a kind of cheesy leek mixture. And then we'll do the little Passover rolls to accompany because nobody's terribly crazy about the matzah in our house. And a recipe, I'm afraid we had to cut recipes. There were recipes that didn't go in, vegetable kugel. But you know the potato kugel that's in the book.
Yes.
Well, I'm getting campaigns at the moment to put that in. And then there'll also be the tagine, because obviously everybody will have that. And mushrooms in red wine, that's also in the book.
Yeah.
Whatever you've got, if you like mushrooms, mushrooms in red wine are just gorgeous, and they make this luscious gravy, and it really is a really, really... And it always seems a bit like a celebration when you serve mushrooms. They have that sort of elegance. They're a little bit posh, as we'd say here. I don't know whether you use the expression posh in America. Currant tart, flavour... and coconut meringues, and by then everybody be so full they won't want to eat for a week.
I guess so.
Usually they don't get as far as the dessert, and they all say, oh, we'll have nothing, and then they pick at the biscuits and have that with coffee. Oh, and I also always make homemade chocolates.
Make
homemade chocolates.
Oh, you're a glutton for punishment.
I am a glutton for punishment, yes.
Now, Ruth, one of the things that's really interesting about this book is that you have these little sidebars where you analyze the dish or an ingredient, and they're so informative. Like, you know.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, the stuff I never even knew, like the forager's pie.
Yes. I love the history of food. I love the origins. I love to know why people started using things. The forager's pie, yes, because, you know, those poor people that lived in Eastern Europe and really were living on ghastly, you know, if they had boiled cabbage every day, they were grateful to get it. And then when the mushrooms came in the woods, oh my word, what a treat. And of course the non-Jewish people wouldn't use mushrooms because called some of the Jews mushrooms. There's a mushroom called Jew's ear. And so the Jews were left with all these mushrooms, which was absolutely glorious. They learned to preserve them, they learned to dry them and pickle them, and then they were their treat for the whole of the year. And I just love all those stories. Mm-hmm. To me, that's the essence of the dish.
Now, you have certainly aided considerably in lusciousness by the photos.
Oh, yes. Aren't I lucky?
Oh, boy, they're wonderful. There are some really compelling dishes here that you just, if you got a hold of this cookbook, listeners, you're just going to focus in on, I keep turning back to this page with the Sephardic hot spiced fish. That looks wonderful.
The Sephardi hot spiced fish. If my son wasn't coming and I had different people coming, I would be serving that. I learned that is the most wonderful story because a lovely lady called Malika taught me how to do the filling in a tiny kitchen in Fez in Morocco.
Oh, wow.
And we hit it off like this, and we just became the bestest of friends. And she couldn't talk English, and I couldn't talk Moroccan, but we managed a bit with a bit of French and sign language. And the joy of watching her cook and showing me, and you know she chops an onion into the palm of her hand. They don't use chopping boards.
Wow.
And to me that was so fascinating. But she showed me how to make the shamoula. And you put it into the middle of the fish. And the flavors that go through the fish are just glorious. And the vegetables, and the joy of that recipe is you can serve it on the day and then cold the next day. It's still marvelous. And you can prepare it a day in advance. It can sit in your fridge happily waiting, and that's got to be such a bonus.
And listeners, I would say this one book, Jewish Traditional Cooking, gives you history, culture, understanding of ingredients, and also absolutely fabulous recipes. You've combined everything you want in a cookbook, Ruth.
Thank you. Thanks so much for saying that. You've really given me the hugest buzz because I put my heart, I put my soul, and I put all my love into it. And if somebody receives that in the way it was given, then that to me gives me huge joy.
And happy holidays to you as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I got very excited when I heard or learned that Randall Graham, Bonnie Doon Vineyards, was experimenting with sparkling wines. And when I tasted them, I got even more excited. Randall doesn't do anything halfway.
He doesn't.
No, and these are really
exceptional. There's nothing he doesn't want to play with either.
No.
So,
and talk about Salvatore, here it is.
Randall Graham is one of America's iconic wine people, a winemaker, a wine marketer, but also a poet. And you have all kinds of other activities, Randall. How do you find time?
I don't sleep. That would be the main way I can do it.
Yeah, that's what Mario Batali always says. Sleep is highly overrated.
But you're always up to something new. And the last time we talked to you, which is two or three years ago, I guess, you said, I'm going to get rid of my old vineyard. I don't like it anymore, and I'm going to start a new one.
Yes.
And that's an effort that's still going on, so we should talk about that in a little bit. But you also are into making wines that, shall we say, are interesting.
So, interesting in a good way, I trust, not just interesting in a horrifying way.
Well, I think some some people would probably describe the idea as idiotic, but then they don't know you as well as we do.
Yeah, I mean, I expected nothing less than really remarkable in the sparkling wines that you just developed and gave us samples of. Even though you said you're reining in your exploratory horns and focusing on core concepts of your business, you must have some time in your hands and want to play a little bit. And if you're playing around, I expect it to be good. And this current batch of sparkling wines, it is wonderful.
Thank you.
Now, where did you get the idea?
Well, whenever anyone says, where did you get X, Y, or Z idea, I usually say drugs. And they're facetiously, of course.
Of course.
But I don't really know where these ideas come from. I mean, it's just, I guess the guiding idea is to try to do something different from everyone else and in a nice way. And there's a finite number of winemaking ideas out there, and I just want to kind of get out to the edge of some of them and really produce something that's a little different from everyone else.
I could have asked the question a little differently, I guess, and because what's going through my mind is sparkling Riesling being produced anywhere else on the planet? Is sparkling Albarino being produced anywhere on the planet?
Well, certainly in Germany they produce a product called Sekt, and it's highly variable in quality. Some of it is really, really great, and some of it is not so great. But it always struck me is these are two of my favorite food groups, the sparkling group and the Riesling group. And sparkling Riesling can be just absolutely sublime. It's one of the greatest things in the world, or can be. And then to answer the other part, I don't think there's any sparkling Albarino out there. I could be wrong, but I've never seen it myself.
I mean, Albarino itself comes a little spritzy, doesn't it?
From Portugal, as Vino Verde, it can be spritzy. And Rias Baixas can be, but generally it's maybe more still than not.
And you're giving it the full treatment, though. This is not just a slightly sparkling fresh wine. This is the full deal, done the way that people make champagne.
Correct, Mezzo Champenoise, which we're not allowed to say anymore, but yeah, that's what it is.
Oh, you're not allowed to say even Champenoise.
No, you're not.
I think you weren't allowed to say
méthode classique or méthode traditionnelle or something like that.
Okay. Oh, wow, so you broke the rules.
And as usual, yes.
The thought police will be after you. One of the more dramatic things, aside from the fascinating labels, which look like you sort of inked each one of them by hand.
Hardly.
I'm sure you didn't, but they sort of look that way. But the presentation is interesting because it doesn't have cork wire.
Correct.
It just has a crown seal, which a lot of people don't know is actually used in the Champagne region for the first fermentation before they put the real corks in. But you just decided that you'd present them this way as a finished product. Why was that?
I think it was potentially a function of expense. I mean, we had already spent so much money making this product that I think any additional expense just would have put it totally over the top.
Yeah, that's what I figured. And,
yeah.
And we have drunk several versions of Prosecco come with the same crown seal.
Yes.
And I guess, again, it's the same reason. It's a part of putting a sparkling wine on the table for a price that's inexpensive, which is what the Prosecco people are trying to do, and it's perhaps not what you're trying to do. You're just trying to lose a little less money.
Exactly.
But, Randall, I mean, it's very limited in production and very limited accessibility here.
Yes.
From your website, but also from, of course, your cellar door. But what was your purpose in doing this? I mean, you're also not going to keep doing it forever.
What
I keep trying to find out how your mind works, and I never get there.
Yeah, well, we have a wine club, which we call Dune, D-E-W-N, that is Distinctive Esoteric Wine Network, and the original value proposition of the club was that we would provide distinctive and esoteric wines to our customers, and so this would be an example of one of those distinctive and esoteric wines.
Okay.
Now, you've got an even more startling, in some respects, wine coming along in the pipeline somewhere, a sparkling red wine.
Correct. I love the idea of sparkling red wine. I love the idea sort of more in concept than in reality, but this actually is quite good. It's a sparkling Syrah that I think will be really lovely.
You said that you're buying the fruit for this one, but it's going to be a continuing project?
I didn't say that, but okay. It could be. I would love to do maybe a sparkling red Pinot Noir. A sparkling red Burgundy would be, quasi-Burgundy, I should say, would be.
Wow.
Pretty nice. Or who knows, maybe Grenache. I don't know that a sparkling Grenache has been attempted.
But by your standards now, this Albarino and the Riesling Sparkling are both success stories.
Absolutely. Not financially, but aesthetically, certainly.
How can you stop making them?
So we lose a little bit on each one, but we make it up in volume. Or not.
So you are up to something else. And when we last talked, we mentioned the fact that you're working on a totally new vineyard. And that's
coming
coming along, and the bad news is, unfortunately, is coming along rather slowly, you said?
That's correct, yes.
Any forecast as to when the first vintages will
be coming? I don't know. We'll have a little bit of fruit next year from a very small planting, a very small amount of fruit. But we've planted a number of things besides grapes. We've planted olive trees and pears and cherries and raspberries, and I think those are going to come along before the grapes do at this rate.
And what are those for?
Well, I'm not sure yet exactly what we'll do. I'm very keen on cider. I love the idea of producing an exotic cider, pear cider especially, pear and quince. So we're going to plant some quince trees this year or next year.
Uh-huh.
And we've also about to release an interesting pear, apple, and quince cider.
Yeah, the American Cheese Society has been helping along a group of cider makers to form a national organization of high-end ciders. Did you know that?
I didn't, but that sounds great.
Yeah. So America's going to start moving into the high-end cider business.
It's only a matter of time. I mean, it's an inevitability, I think.
Now, the one you think things you won't be able to make, I guess, out there are ice wines and ice ciders, which they make in Vermont, but I guess it's not quite cold enough.
Not in California, generally speaking.
Although you might find a way. I don't know that I would put it past you not to find a way how to do that.
We made a faux ice wine for many, many years called Vin de Glacière, where we took the grapes and put them in a freezer, and that worked very, very well. Honestly, I'm just really not so into artifice these days. I'd rather make wines in a more natural, less affected style.
Now, you have that said, you have a new way fermenting and aging your wines, which you were telling us about before we came on the air, which I'm guessing not a lot of people are doing. So tell us about the demijohns. I mean, they sound like awful things. But.
Oh, no. So actually, this is not really the fermentation of the wine. It's really the élevage of the wine. So
okay.
We make our wine, cigar, in this case, Cigar Volant and Cigar Blanc, really as we would our normal wine. And in fact, it is the same wine as our normal bottling, except after the initial assemblage, we add a little bit of sulfur to it, and we put it down with the lees into 5-gallon glass demijohns or carboys, they call them, and put them on their side, totally anaerobic, totally sealed up, and then we do a batonnage using strong magnets and stir bars inside the bottles every month just to agitate the lees. And the result of the anaerobic or reductive élevage plus the extreme autolysis of the wine gives us a really interesting product. It's very savory. It has a beautiful texture, a lot of complexity and nuance. It's kind of a new winemaking idea. And the only other person I know who does anything like this is Emidio Pepe in Abruzzo. But to my knowledge, no one else does anything like this.
But Pepe is actually a volume person. His daughter is doing the more interesting stuff. Huh?
Yes.
Now, this is the father, right?
Yes. Or the winery, yeah, Pepe.
No, I mean, he makes expensive wines.
Yeah, but it's more volume stuff than.
Well, I wouldn't call it volume because he's in the premium wine category, undoubtedly, right, Randall?
To my knowledge, yes, absolutely.
And that's exactly
as far as I know.
That's exactly where he is. His daughter, who
she's in organic or biologic.
Yeah, she bought her own property because she wanted to do things her way, and she is much more biologic and wants each wine to express each little mini acre of wine, of grapes, of ground from which the grapes are grown. That doesn't make her any different than quite a lot of people, I guess.
But her father's trying to do this that you're doing. I mean, he's been doing it, or he's just starting, or what?
Oh, no, Pepe's been making this aging wines in demijohns for years, for the last 25 years, to my knowledge.
But I think you're talking about this magnetic thing.
Oh, no, the magnetic thing is a Santa Cruz innovation.
I never heard of it.
No, it's proprietary to Bonny Doon.
This is how you do it.
This is how we do it, yes.
Yeah, the style of doing it, Pepe is doing.
Well, the fact that we're aging it in demijohns, which is unique, and I think there's something special about glass, and there's something special about just the length of time. And we are not aging it in glass as long as he is, to my knowledge, but nevertheless, it still produces a really distinctive product.
Now, what's these wines are called what?
Cigar Volant Reserve, okay. En Bonbon, and Cigar Blanc Reserve En Bonbon.
So that's a bonbon. So that listeners, if you want the latest in interesting wines, those are ones to try. Again, people can get them through the website.
That's correct. Yes.
Which is just so that people don't have to really work hard.
Oh, it's bonnyjunevineyard.com.
Well, thank you for getting up so early in the morning to talk to us. Though I guess
he's on the east coast.
I guess you're on the right coast, not the left coast. So it's a reasonable time to get up. And we have been sampling sparkling Albarino as we have talked to Randall, and it is absolutely delicious and most unusual. I don't think I've ever smelled a wine that was quite as yeasty in the bottle. It tastes like it's real sparkling wine. I mean, it smells like it's real sparkling wine.
Nice. That's very kind.
Great. Well, have a great trip and enjoy your return to California. And thank you so much for joining us today.
My great pleasure.
Good to talk to you, Randall. Thanks.
Thank you, Anne. Take care. Yeah. Bye-bye now.
And we'll have more about Ireland in following St. Patrick's Day right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Of course, by now you know you're listening to Anne and Peter Haig with On the Menu. We're delighted that you're with us today. And we had St. Patrick's Day just a week ago, but we were thinking Ireland before that, and we think of Ireland after that, and you can think of Ireland too. So if a taste of Ireland is something that takes your fancy, or you're interested in a new way of planning a visit to the Emerald Isle, listen carefully to our next guest.
If you've been following our interviews on the menu, you will know that one of the places we love to go and a place where we love the food is actually Ireland. So we're very pleased today to have Margaret Jeffers on the phone, who represents an organization called Good Food Ireland, and what could be wrong with that? Welcome to On the Menu, Margaret.
Thank you very, very much, Anne. Delighted to be on your show.
Well, until I was contacted by a publicist here, Amy, I didn't know there was Good Food Ireland, although there's Good Food Australia, so I guess there would be Good Food Ireland. Why don't you tell our listeners something about this organization?
Well, we're just kind of having our debut here in the U.S. Really just our first one was, our debut was last October, and we're back here again to launch kind of a new second generation website. And Good Food Ireland is an organization that I founded about 5 years ago, and it's about authentic food experience in Ireland. So if you're a food lover and you want to come to Ireland and you want to have an amazing food experience, Good Food Ireland is your friend and will show you the way. But I suppose Good Food Ireland is something that very much evolved for me. It wasn't as if I woke up one night and said, I'm going to found an organization tomorrow. It's something that came about in my head through the needs of the industry in Ireland, where they were looking for standout and recognition for this commitment to local food over other competitors. And also it was because of the whole change of visitors coming into Ireland. And I think this was very much a global change, probably because of food scares and food safety, where there was a growing awareness and a growing seek out nearly for provenance and local food experiences so that food would be safe to eat. And this is kind of going back to around maybe 2004, 2005, when the idea was evolving in my head. And then international visitors coming into Ireland were beginning to ask, where can we eat? Now, traditionally, visitors would have booked accommodation or flights and car hire, and that was it. But this was a whole new change in consumer behavior coming into Ireland. So I very much felt that if I could try to bring together all of these amazing, amazing food providers, be it a small little restaurant, coffee shop, all the way through to your B&B, to your five-star hotel, that are all culinary experiences and committed to using this local Irish ingredient and bring them together and promote them to international visitors, we will have a fantastic experience of Ireland. And they in turn, as in the providers and the businesses, will in turn buy more local food for Irish from Irish farmers, Irish food producers and Irish fishermen, which will create a greater economy in Ireland and grow the whole regional spread for our country. So it's kind of a very big vision based on food experience, but something that recession in Ireland in ways has helped, because everybody's beginning to look back more into their local communities and into supporting each other. So there's some good things out of this, and it's a whole growing innovation in Irish food that has happened over the last 5 to 10 years.
What were you doing before?
My background, Peter, has always been tourism marketing internationally, so I've always had first-hand experience of what visitors want when they come to Ireland. And obviously, the key drivers for people coming into Ireland, and especially out of the US market, are our people, are our number one, and our scenery. So here was I trying to say, okay, how can I start positioning food as an important driver? But the reality is, everybody's got to eat. So I felt then that what I would do is promote the people behind the food and the authenticity of these people, because food and the agri-food sector is completely at the core of Irish culture and Irish tradition. We're an island nation. Agriculture and tourism are our two biggest industries. So if I could bring the people behind the food, from the chef to the cheesemaker, the butcher, the baker, and promote them internationally, international visitors and international consumers will start seeing the people and the faces of these producers and bakers and butchers and cheesemakers. And then it just happens that food comes in behind it. So it's very, very much about getting food experience. And I'm always asked as well about, we don't have a culinary reputation in Ireland for cuisine. People know us for our bacon and our cabbage and our potatoes, of which we're very, very proud of. But there are traditional dishes. Whole wave of innovation in Irish food over the last maybe 5 years has been about an ingredient-led experience where new ingredients and products and produce has come into chef's purchasing power, and basically they can go out and buy this wonderful food now.
Right. Hold on a second.
We had Clodagh McKenna on the program just a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
And she was singing very much the same tune, and said that she had herself had a lot to do with establishing farmers markets, and that's a very important part of the food culture.
Absolutely.
As well, I guess.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. Clodagh was very involved many years ago on getting the kind of the farmers market movement going again in Ireland. So there's this whole groundswell of innovation happening in Ireland around food. And it's funny, because when I kind of came up with the idea of Good Food Ireland, my dad said to me, Margaret, you're going to need a recession for people to go back to our roots. Now, at the time, that was way over my head. We were in the height of a thriving economy and the Celtic Tiger. So to understand even a recession was far from my thoughts. But when he said go back to our roots, farmers markets and local food was always at the roots of Irish people and totally entwined in the fabric of our whole society and our culture. And we are probably all directly from farming background, if not at most one generation away from farming. It's a small agricultural community, Ireland is. So I suppose what Good Food Ireland does that is the first, and why it is so different and so unique, is that through a brand and through a one-stop shop for an international visitor coming into Ireland that is a food lover, they can have that experience through one channel and find out where to go. And this is where, after the first 5 years, because we're just 5 years old, it has always been about developing the businesses behind the brand, and they're all inspected independently to ensure that they meet our consumer promise, which is an Irish ingredient-led experience of the best food that you can eat in Ireland.
Now, who inspects them? Who maintains these standards?
We have a group of independent inspectors that go out and check out these places to ensure. But because we're not a government organization, we're an industry group, there's a great camaraderie between everybody, and there's a great trust, nearly, and that can seem quite naive, but Ireland is small. It's a small little pool. So people buy into this philosophy because it is many of their own philosophy for 20, 30 years. And what Good Food Ireland is doing is it's giving them that international marketing distribution and that recognition for what they do, like Clodagh is now doing in her business, like what they're doing every day in their business, and it's bringing that one-stop shop to the consumer that wasn't there before. And because the brand was so pioneering 5 years ago, because it completely excludes anything that is not authentic food experience, it is less commercial as an organization to operate like this. So, and because we have a standard, which inspections cost money. But I always believe that if we don't have a standard and we don't have approvals to meet our promise to our customers, we're never going to have an organization. And we're going to down our image of food tourism for Ireland, when I know and I truly believe that we can be one of the top food tourism destinations in Europe, without a doubt. We have all the raw ingredients. We're an island nation. We are the biggest exporters of beef and other food produce, primary proteins, in Europe. And we have all of this amazing raw ingredient. And then in the last 5-10 years, we have chefs that can now create this amazing culinary cuisine. So Irish food today is Irish ingredient-led experiences, and that's what Good Food Ireland brings to your listeners.
Okay, now, a lot of this information is accessible for, if you like, self-service exploration on your website, goodfoodireland.ie. But is there any support in addition to that? I mean, can people get like a concierge to help them plan their journey if they can't figure it out for themselves?
Absolutely. And this is what we're just launching really at the moment, in addition to the My Food Trip planning experience, where we have our top food trips. And on our site at the moment live, we have about maybe 8 or 9 trips that we have custom built, and they're our top food trips. And next week we're going to add some more, and we're going to keep adding them more and more, and I'm hoping to have maybe even 100 in the next 6 months on our website. So your listeners will be able to go on and do a search for maybe a 3-day holiday, a 5-day holiday, a 14-day holiday of Ireland, and they can also refine that search around heritage, around culture, around even a golf trip. So it isn't just a website that's for people coming to have just food. It's for everybody who calls themselves a lover of good food that wants to have a holiday in Ireland. So if it's a golf weekend or it's a sightseeing trip, you can still get all of those searches or refine your search to give you the best golf courses, but it's around food. So it's really a food lover's dream, the website.
Now, you're helping to bring Irish products into the retail market in the United States, and I'm assuming other countries too, correct?
Yes, that's right, Peter. And again, that's a whole new excitement for us, because again, it wasn't something we planned to do. It was something that evolved, because when we went overseas promoting the Good Food Ireland, we always did it through food tastings. And people would say to us, wow, Margaret, you know, this food is absolutely amazing. Where can we buy it? And I would be saying to them, oh, you got to come to Ireland to taste this food. So it was kind of a two-edged sword. As much as we wanted them to come to Ireland, we wanted them to experience it in their homes as well. So that was really what drove the food shop. And of course, the little artisan food producers that are on that shop are all very small, premium businesses that would never have the wherewithal to even develop an online shop to sell internationally. So Good Food Ireland has probably has just brought them all together. So you can a la carte buy 10 different items, have them put in a box, and deliver them to your door.
Now, we received something, but it came via Dean and DeLuca. So it was, I would say it was outrageously expensive.
Wow. Well, we're actually doing some food tastings in Dean and DeLuca tomorrow, so...
But there are other ways of getting this besides Dean and DeLuca.
Absolutely.
One bag of oatmeal was $10.
Wow. Okay. But I can promise you, Anne, it will be really, really good.
It better be good.
It better be good for $10.
It'll really, really be good. I suppose oatmeal is one of those overseas, it's kind of a traditional thing, probably, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, to have weekends when it's made, and you know, you cook it on the stove, and it's a great experience, and it's such a whole stable, part of the stable diet, really, whole oatmeal.
Yeah, and I guess my question was, can you get the products at more reasonable cost through some other outlet than Dean and DeLuca?
Well, I don't know. I'm not familiar with the prices, to be honest with you, for Irish food ingredient here in the U.S. But I know that, you know, on our food shop, they're very reasonably priced. With artisan food produce, because we are promoting the people behind the food and they're very small providers, we're buying that produce from them at premium prices. So we're not like, you know, a large supermarket chain that squeezes the producer to make more money. We're absolutely not like that. We're taking very, very small markup. And I suppose that's another reason why our shop is so unique. There's not large commodity brands on it, where with large commodity brands, you get greater percentage in profit. Whereas, as I was saying, with small producers, you don't get that because we deliberately don't squeeze the small producer. So our margins are very, very small. Therefore, because we have two things, we want to promote the Irish food, and that's probably our core objective, and we want to get it to you in the U.S. as affordable as possible.
Well,
but
now,
obviously,
hold on a second. I just want to make sure that I have this right. So the shop you're referring to is a part of the Good Food Ireland website.
Yes. Absolutely, yeah.
And you can make up your own order by going through the items online, like with a shopping cart, and then checking out your shopping cart.
Correct.
Now, how is that actually fulfilled? Are the goods already in the United States?
No, we're shipping direct from Ireland.
Shipping direct, okay.
So, Peter, there's limited product because all food items have to be licensed to go into the States. So when you go onto our website, you will see what's U.S. compliant and what's not. And obviously, there are less that are U.S. compliant. But we have one food experience. We also had food experience boxes where we put together a collection of the boxes, the food, should I say, and you can buy a food experience box and have it shipped. Now then there's costs of shipping, which is tough enough and price-wise.
Sure, but it
is a very special experience, and it really is. It's a unique product. They're unique products for Ireland. Many of them are not even for sale here in the U.S., so quite special.
Margaret, if somebody wants to take advantage of your tour planning, trip planning, what's the first step? Go on your website?
Go onto our website and have a look at our top food trip and just see how we create those. And you can just see the type of information that's there for you. But also on the homepage of the website, there's a video to tell you how to plan your own trip. So if you feel you know Ireland and you're confident with your search, you can go into the different counties around Ireland, north, south, east, or west, and you can do a search, and you can refine that search by theme or by things to do. And you can build that trip for yourself. So it stays on the website for you for up to 30 days, and you can come back every day and refine it. And you can share it across Facebook with your friends. You can get your friends to give suggestions as well. And just to ensure that you're very, very happy with where you're going and you want to get the best experience as possible. So that's all there. And even the food trips that we have created, and as I say, we'll be adding to them every day. We're adding to them now. Say, for example, there may be one there for Cork. That's a two-day trip to Cork. So if you're on holiday in Ireland for 15 days or 14 days, you might decide to add that whole trip to your trip. And you can also, even on our trips, even our 14-day trip that's up there at the moment, you might say, oh, I don't want to stay in that hotel in Dublin. I want to stay in another hotel in Dublin. So you can actually delete that hotel and you can add in another hotel to our trips as well. So they're there very much to help you build your own trip. And you can view it in list format, and where it just tells you all the places with a little overview. And then you can also view it in map format. So you can literally have a map of Ireland, and through the Google location base, you will see your trip all around Ireland.
Well, you're getting us excited about coming to Ireland again already, and we only were there 4 months ago. So, Margaret, thank you so much for joining us on the menu today. We wish you great success with adventures, and we greatly subscribe to the fact that everyone should go to Ireland as often as they can.
Oh, thank you so much, Peter. And I very, very much look forward to you and Anne coming over again. And use Good Food Ireland, and we'll help you on your way. It'll be fantastic.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Margaret.
And right after the break, you're going to find out what New York Mouth is all about, so don't go away. We'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Of course, I fell in love with the name first. Talk about cool. The name, New York Mouth. But then I fell also for the concept. You get all this delicious stuff without all the dilemma because they do that legwork for you. Let's listen to how you can share in the goodies uncovered by New York Mouth. Craig Kanarek. Is that right, Kanarek?
Yes, it is, Kanarek.
Yeah. That's a great name, but you also have a great name for your company called New York Mouth. Tell us, what is New York Mouth?
New York Mouth is the premier destination for indie food online. So we are an online-only retailer, what we call indie food.
You have to explain indie.
Well, the easiest way to understand it, I think, is to draw the comparison to indie music or indie film. So what we found was that there's been a lot of attention paid to food over the last few years. It's really been growing. And in particular, there's been this sort of new community of members getting into the food product business. And those people are really the independent makers of food products. So they're not part of the large industrial complex of food manufacturing, but are really the small batch handmade makers. What we found, though, were that the terms like small batch or local or artisanal were somewhat pedantic and somewhat prescriptive and didn't really fit what we were trying to do. And we just found that the idea of calling it indie food was a lot more flexible and also a lot more accurate about what these people were trying to do.
Yeah, the spirit of the whole thing. I agree.
Exactly.
On your little card where you say all the things you love delicious, you say you can't help but love beautiful packaging. We loved your packaging. Could you describe what that is?
Well, yeah, thank you. What we do, what we're trying to do with our packaging is create a real sense of adventure, the same sort of sense of adventure that you would get if you were going to a local farmer's market or visiting one of these makers. And so we wanted to make the experience of shopping on our website as well as the experience of opening up the package and unwrapping the product a really exciting experience. At the same time, we wanted to make sure that we kept it very eco-friendly and responsible to the environment. So what we do is we actually take each of the products that we ship, we wrap them in single-faced corrugated cardboard. So it has a lovely craft cardboard wrapper around it. And then we seal it up with some tape. And we put everything into a heavy-duty cotton tote bag and then put that into a cardboard box that we actually brand here in the warehouse with branding iron.
Wow. Amazing. Now, when did you start this business?
We started the business about a year and a half ago.
Who did you decide was your audience when you launched this? Who were you aiming to have as an audience?
Well, the first answer to that is always it was really for me in some ways. These were products that I was buying at various places. And so some of it came out of my own desire to create a destination where I could shop online for these products that I normally had to drive all over New York City and Brooklyn for. And so I wanted to create that same sort of convenience for people like me. But I think there's so many people out there who are really interested in new food and in foods that are made in a more interesting way and in a more healthy way that almost anybody who is going to spend time going to Whole Foods or gourmet cheese shops is going to find the stuff that we have on NewYorkMouth.com to be compelling.
Tell us what some of your favorite food items are.
Oh, it's such a challenging question. It's like telling you what my favorite child is.
Yeah, I know.
For us, it's always some of the new products are the most interesting, as well as some of the classics. You know, we were talking earlier, Peter, you and I, about this drink that we just started carrying called Switchel, which is made by the Vermont Switchel Company. And it's a very old recipe. It's a sort of traditional New England thirst quencher, and it's made with maple syrup, apple cider vinegar, ginger, and molasses.
That'll cure you.
It will. I think it's a thirst quencher and a health tonic at the same time. And it's really great. It's great in the winter. You can drink it hot. You can add some rum to it or some other spirits. And it's also really good as a thirst quencher just over ice.
And of course, you have to have chocolate, right?
We do. And we're very excited about what's been going on in the chocolate world over the last couple of years. There's been a renewed interest here in the United States to make craft chocolate bars, and part of that is really starting with the beans and going all the way from bean to bar. We really think that it's just scratching the surface, but we have some amazing chocolates. We have one that's made here in Red Hook, Brooklyn, by a company called Cacao Prieto, and chocolate is actually grown in Dominican Republic on the owner of the company's plantation. So he has a chocolate factory in Brooklyn and a cacao plantation, his grandfather's cacao plantation in Dominican. So he controls the process all the way from the planting of the cacao all the way through to when the bars are produced and shipped out. And we have some by him that are plain chocolate. We also have ones that are topped with fruit and nut. Another one of the chocolate producers that I am really liking right now is something called Choco Vivo, which is a stone ground chocolate that's made in Los Angeles.
Wow.
And it's a completely different texture than what people are used to. It's almost like a whole grain type of experience, like a whole grain bread would be. It's chunkier. It's not a smooth chocolate. But it really is the way the chocolate was originally made by the Indian tribes in Mexico, the Mayans and the Aztecs. It was ground by stone. And as a result, it's not as smooth as a metal ground chocolate. But all that air in the chocolate and the sort of coarseness of the sugar crystals makes for a really interesting mouthfeel and a really delicious product.
And of course, you know, if you're searching out products in Brooklyn, you're going to have pickles.
Absolutely. We just had one of our favorites delivered, something called the New York City Deli Pickle by a company called Brooklyn Brine.
Oh, I love Brooklyn Brine.
They're doing some really interesting things, yeah, both in terms of sort of traditional packaged pickles as well as lacto-fermentation. We're not selling those because of the refrigeration needed, but we really love a lot of the products that they're making, and the New York City delis are one of our favorites.
What's the scale? Just to give our listeners an idea of the scale of the operation, how many items are in the current catalog?
We have about 300 or so individual products on the website, and they range from pickles to beef jerky to hot sauces to sunflower oil, candy bars, and seasonings, jam, spread. So there's really a wide range of things.
And you go to newyorkmouth.com.
That's right.
And there's a list of the products.
There's a list of all the products. So we have sort of three, what we call three categories of products. We have individual products themselves, like a jar of pickles or a jar of Bloody Mary mix. We also have what we call tasters, which are our pre-selected bundles of goodies. So, for example, we have the Brooklyn Taster, which is a handful of products all made in Brooklyn. And so those are really ideal for gifts. And we also have a bunch of subscription products. So we have pickles every month where you can subscribe for 3 or 6 or 12 months and have a few jars of pickles delivered to you or your favorite pickle lover every month.
That's brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. And I thought there was another option for the of the month thing.
Well, we have 8 of them. One of my personal favorite is the one that we call Cookies Every Night, which is still a monthly subscription, but we make sure that there's at least 30 cookies in each box so that you can have a glass of milk and a cookie every night before you go to bed.
Good oh, my God. And the next business venture you're going to have is a diet company?
It's possible, yeah. We might have to start selling some exercise equipment. Now, look, we have a lot of those things on the site that are sweet and rewards. We also have a lot of cooking products and savory products as well.
Don't laugh at this. My trainer, who owns the gym, that's only half of her business. The other half is as a bake shop.
Well, that's good. So she's getting the customers in both directions, huh?
Exactly. I thought that was very interesting. Now, where are you heading with this? First of all, how do you select? There are so many. I mean, we know from personal experience, there are so many products out there. And you're sitting in the heart of it with Brooklyn and Vermont and all that. How do you go about, and people are probably throwing these products at you all the time, every day.
Yeah, and it's one of the most exciting parts of our job and also one of the trickiest parts of our job. You know, what we're trying to do is, first and foremost, the product has to taste great. That's the most important thing, is that these products have to be delicious. But it goes beyond that, and the spirit of making them, where the ingredients come from, the level of, let's say, additives and preservatives, the packaging and the way that the product is presented, all of that is part of the experience. And we have a group of us here internally that evaluate all the products. We've gotten to the point now where we have to taste. We only taste products on Friday mornings because it's just too difficult to taste them as they get delivered. There's too many of them.
Who all is on this group, this panel?
So it's a handful of us here inside the company, and then what we try to do is invite a couple of guests every week to come in and give us their opinions as well, so that some of our friends come by and we get a wide range of tastes involved in helping us choose what goes on the site and what doesn't.
Okay, and long range, what is your goal for this?
Well, you're just getting started. It's been a great 14 months that we've been doing this, and where we have big categories that we want to add, we also want to continue to expand some of the categories that we think we're really doing a great job in. We want to have the best pickle store on the internet, and we also want to have the best chocolate store on the internet. So some of our categories you're going to see we're going to expand quite drastically. And then there are things that we have on that we don't even have on the site yet, the entire categories of products that we're trying to figure out how to sell effectively. We've really spent almost all of last year shipping products that are shelf-stable, don't require significant refrigeration. We do sell a few refrigerated products, but not many. So we're going to be expanding that selection over the next few months, which is probably the first change that you'll see coming up for us.
Now, what's the arrangement that you have with the people whose goods you supply? Are they exclusive to New York Mouth, or
no,
you don't have a requirement for that at all?
We don't have a requirement. We operate, for as far as our relationship with our makers go, is we operate like a traditional retail model. We purchase the product from the makers, we hold it in stock in our warehouse in Brooklyn, and we ship it out to our customers. We, of course, would prefer that we get some exclusive products, and for some companies, some of these companies are extremely small and have not yet scaled up their production to be able to handle multiple distributors. Others are quite large and are in a lot of places, but part of the service we're trying to provide is a selection of products that are not easy to find anywhere else. So hopefully the stuff that we have on the website is going to be unique and not something that you can find in every Kroger and every supermarket across the country.
And not only that, that anybody buying from you knows that the product's already been vetted by a group of experts.
Exactly right. Here we spend a lot of time and energy in making sure that the products are great and trying to narrow down this huge range of products that are out there and making sure that these are ones that our customers are going to enjoy.
Well, I mean, I can't even remember how I learned about you, but I'm certainly glad I did.
I'm glad you did, too. I hope you enjoyed some of the things that we had sent you to try.
Well, yes, we're going to be enjoying them. Exactly. I love the jerky stuff.
The jerky is great. We have some really interesting flavors. In particular, we sent you a sample of some king salmon jerky.
Yes.
Which we think is great. It's a good alternative for people who don't want to eat beef. Here in New York, we call it a lox in a bag. It's really a great way to portable. It's dried. You can keep it in your bag with you wherever you go. And it's an interesting story. It's made by a very old smokehouse here in New York. I think it's the sole remaining smokehouse in Brooklyn. Comes in two flavors, a teriyaki flavor and a peppered flavor, and it's really delicious.
I'm going to pop some of this high cacao chocolate in my mouth right now, Craig.
Oh, you have the cacao Prieto bar from Red Hook, correct?
Yes.
So we better say goodbye.
You want the chocolate.
Otherwise, Anne's going to be biting my arm or hand off instead.
I totally understand. Well, you can follow it up with some delicious triple ginger cookies that we sent you.
We have those, too. Craig, it's been great talking to you and hearing about your company. I'm sure we'll be in touch as you go along.
Well, I hope so. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you.
Okay, listeners, as I say, that's a wrap for today's program. We hope you'll join the same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.